doing that, I'll just introduce Pranilla. Pranilla Manjula Philip uses lived experience as a starting point for researching the topic of chronic illness and its connection to the biomedical industrial complex. Pranilla is particularly motivated by ways of hacking and tinkering as collaborative tools of activism and how this informs new structures of collective care. And I'm going to hand you over to her.
So thank you, Kanash, for introducing me. I'm Pernilla, and I'm also a part of Hackers and Designers. I will start to describe myself. I have a long and brown hair. I'm both Indian and white. I'm wearing a zebra shirt and tie-dye pants, which are also very noisy when I walk, making me a little bit, yeah, don't know. I want to talk a little bit about myself, but hopefully also how I connect, how my personal story also connects to other people's stories and collectives. I'm a designer and artist before I became chronically ill with a type 1 diabetes. I have in the last few years, with the help of a handful of important tutors and teachers, been creating a practice where I use my design skills as or methods of design to talk about my experience of how it is to always need care and what it's like to be in a system of care as a caretaker and a caregiver. Because of course, like, I mean, even though I'm living in very much in this system of I have several doctors and I have a delivery of pharmacy materials straight to my house on a regular basis, that I'm not unique with needing care, because that's something we all in different ways need. But for me, I get my insulin via the pharmacy into my fridge, and then via the porousness of my skin, I receive insulin on a regular minute by minute basis, actually. And it's analog and digital information that is constantly being wirelessly sent through my between my devices and my body. I want to talk about what it is to be dependent on a system like this, which is like very, very technical, and there's a lot of people involved and a lot of history and future studies and also ultimately what it is to become dependent on this whole system. When the pandemic first happened, I was very scared about like my deliveries not coming on time, and I remember calling my insulin supplier, and every time the phone would get disconnected, and would just, and I did this a few times, and the first time I wasn't really listening to what the voice was saying, and then the second time I couldn't listen because I was getting so scared. And then eventually, I don't know how, but like I realized that it was a Saturday, and that was the reason why the phone line was getting disconnected. But the sheer like panic of like realizing, okay, well, I'm not even like there's like vaccines and there's this, but there's like just like the continuous delivery of my my insulin. And anyway, I wanted to also, in order to talk about a little bit more about my system, I think it's interesting to look a little bit about the history of how this system that I use was created. So to keep it brief, there was a few slides back. There was I use an insulin pump, and this insulin pump is constantly delivering insulin, and then I have another device on my skin that is measuring my blood sugars, and they are made by two different companies, and they are not really well communicated with each other. There are some experimental techniques where they are combined, but it's very, very limited. The reason is several, there's also maybe perhaps several reasons that I don't know about, but one of the most outspoken one is safety. And to create like any type of medical devices or systems, there is first of all, a very expensive process to get medical devices approved, and it also takes a very, very long time, meaning that a lot of the devices that I use are extremely outdated. So the device for the insulin pump, the official device, looks like a Nokia phone from 1999, and it also functions in that same way. So a little bit of the history. I came across a article written in an astronaut site and via a chain of links. But so I've learned that in the 1950s, end of 1950s, there was this is a real tongue twister. Two men called Kleins and Klein who developed clinical trials for they called projections into the future of cybernetic organisms. So they were looking into medical problems in human space travels, and one of the things they were wanted to develop is a pump for continuous injection, and looking for ways to involuntarily and remotely administer drugs. So they spoke about issues of astronauts developing a psychosis or something where they could not administer the drug themselves. So how could they from Earth administer drugs? And of course, because this is future studies, the clinical trials for such research was done on other institutionalized patients and not on astronauts. So the trials began in the 1960s with extremely experimental treatments for people with symptoms of schizophrenic episodes. And reading some of the quotes from these patients, it's quite clear that they were very questionable on an ethic level, like what it's like to give drugs to people who actually are not aware that they are even receiving drugs. So this was 1960s, and in the 1980s, this developed into this insulin pump, which is became available on the market for insulin. So, and it changed from remote administering to sort of to self-management. So it had sort of like the same technique became a little bit of a different function. But of course, even if it's self-management, it is still very much of a controlled device. So there's a lot of features that are disabled from being used, and there's a lot of alarms. So there's a lot of alarms, over alarms. So you have to turn it on, off every time there's an alarm, and these are all falling under the umbrella of safety. So there's a lot of safety features, but this is also rendering the devices extremely useless in a sense. Useless, but let's not optimal in how me or other patients really want to use them. So this has also brought up a community of people who want to solve this. and solve it in a way of, like, for example, making the two devices communicate with each other. Essentially, the reader sending to the pump the information of what sort of insulin delivery we need, and also shutting it off when it's becoming too low. So there's a group of hackers around the world who made this code available for download. And I started using this code about 3 years ago. And I started, the first thing you do is, like, you, it's like quite, like, I'd say, like quite a technical threshold in order to start. So, and it is also a very emotional threshold as well, because it's not, it doesn't go, there's a lot of, like, implications when you start taking control of your own treatment. And one of the things is, like, I still never met anybody else who runs on the same system as me. So if I was to be hospitalized, for example, the first thing that would happen is that I would have to start running a new system. So it's also kind of it's quite a lonely process to go into this, but it is way more efficient. And for example, I have way better sleeps, like a lot better sleeps, and that in itself is worth it for me. But talking about these, like, thresholds and these hurdles to get there, like the technical threshold is maybe a little bit more easier for some than others. So it's also not that it's possible for everybody to use these hacked devices, because you first of all have to be hooked up to connected to, like, a health insurance, which I am living in Europe. But and there's a lot of, like, hacks also of for people who are living without health insurance, of, like, how you can reuse devices, how you can change the battery, or how you can make your devices last longer by restarting them, or adding a code that doesn't make them expire until you want them, you start noticing that it's time to replace it. So it's like pushing beyond this 10 day limit that my devices actually have. So there's a lot of different types of, like, code and different types of hacks to do to learn to treat my form of diabetes. I wanted to talk a little bit more also about, like, these safety features that are, like, very much separating, like, say, like, the official devices from hack devices, because a lot of people feel that it's unsafe to use these devices. But then I also want to, that's also why I think it's interesting to look at the history, because, like, there is also a blurring of, like, these things. There isn't so much of a safe versus the unsafe, because there are steps along the ways where the official devices were definitely not safe, like talking about these institutionalized patients. I think it's also interesting to think that, to know that there's a, like, this hack device that I'm using has been available for about 4 to 5 years. And now there are clinical trials going on, and about, like, an official device doing the same as the hack device. So there's a lot of, like, overlap. But the devices that are coming to the market that are closed loop, as we call this, where devices are communicating, they are still burdened by a lot of these, like, safety features, because this is what makes it possible to get through all these lengthy approval of devices. So these alarms, for example, when you hear an alarm 10 times in a day and 5 times in a night, you don't hear them anymore. It's just not possible to recognize them in your. So I've slept through a lot of very high alarms, and I still do, because they're still alarms. So it's not I'm not running an automatic system. It's still a lot of labor. So I mean, in essence, like for me as a user, what is safe for me is what works best. And what works best for me is like a combination between these two type of devices. I think, we can talk more later.
Thank you, Pernilla.